not start for some friends who live in another city until last week. And so their back-to-school pictures of their children were not posted on social media until last week. In this case, there were two pictures. The first one is a young boy who is all smiles. I mean, good-looking young man, obviously has his back-to-school clothes on, and he's smiling ear to ear, holding a sign that says, fourth grade, age 9. That's the first picture. The second picture is a younger boy also holding a sign, and his sign reads, second grade, age 7. He is not smiling at all. He is obviously less than thrilled about the end of his summer break. Here's what their mom said to accompany these pictures that were posted. In her post, she says, the older boy was up early and dressed early, ready to go to school. And in reference to the younger son, she says, and I quote, he was still getting dressed when it was time to leave, declaring his dislike for school and refusing to take pictures. Obviously, he lost that battle. There was a picture of him scowling with his second grade sign. I have to admit, I feel a kindred spirit with the younger boy. I have this sneaking suspicion that the look on my face when I began second grade was probably very similar to his. But I have a far more compelling question for all of us this morning. If we were to take a back-to-church picture of you, and we took it early this morning before you came, what sort of look would have been on your face? Would you be all smiles? I can't wait to worship. I can't wait to have some time with other Christians, and I'm back to church. I'm all about it. It's Sunday morning, and I'm so very enthused. Or would your picture look a little more like the second grader, scowling, thinking it's Sunday, let's go, let's get this over with, let's hope he has a short sermon, on and on and on. But the look, this visual image of you, would convey so much about what's going on with you internally. What sort of internal processes are going on in your heart and in your mind about being a Christian and having the distinct blessing of worshiping with other believers? Internally, what is going on with you? When you're asked to do something for someone else, you're asked, we're going to have the opportunity to teach fifth graders or sixth graders or maybe kindergarten, is your mindset, I can't wait, what an opportunity? Or is it a scowl? I wouldn't do that in a million years. And once again, it conveys something significant and something that's very internal. Even when you're especially disappointed and discouraged, do you have that ability to find some sense of joy in the Lord? And that's conveyed not only internally, but externally as well. So this fall, I'm preaching through the book of James. The title of this series is Excuse the Mess, Faith Under Construction. All of our faith is under construction. God is very much still working in our lives. Last week, we spent some time in James chapter 1, verses 2 through 4. Consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith develops perseverance. Perseverance must finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. Wow, that's a component of working on our faith, is it not? The idea that we can adapt and even thrive and even grow and mature as a consequence of experiencing significant trials. Today, we're going to focus on what really is an internal process, far more so than an external process. And that's James chapter 1, 13 through 15. It's a short section, but it's profound and it really speaks to our lives. So in 13, he says, when tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me, for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when by his own evil desire, he is dragged away and enticed. I'm going to read that passage one more time. Last week when we read James chapter 1, 2 through 4, I said, would you be willing to listen with your head first? As the text speaks to the rational part of your brain, let's read that text first time. Let it speak to your head. And then last week I said, second time, how does this passage speak to your heart? So I'm going to do something really different today, totally different. I'm going to read the passage one more time slowly. I want to ask you to think like a visual learner. Some of us are visual learners. If you can draw us a picture, if I can look at YouTube, I can figure out to do almost anything because I'm naturally a visual learner. So just for a moment, I want to encourage all of us to be visual learners. As I read this passage, what sort of image is conjured up in your head? What do you see? What sort of experience do you imagine visually speaking as I read this passage? Let's be visual learners and read James 1, 13 through 15 one more time. When tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when by his own evil desire he is dragged away and enticed. What sort of image do you have in your mind as you think about what he is describing in this short section of verses here in James chapter 1? Now, I have to admit, I'm kind of a concrete learner. I'm sort of a concrete thinker, probably to a fault. Not probably, I think I am a concrete thinker to a fault. So here's the image I have in my mind. I think of an event. This is an event that happened where someone is tempted and someone's dragged away and enticed, and I think of this all unfolding in about 10 minutes. It's an event. That's what I have in my mind, and I think, I really don't think that's what James had in mind. I think James is describing a far more lengthy and complex process that's far more internal than it is external. The idea of being tempted, the concept of being dragged away and enticed to something that could be going on in our mind for a long, long time. Something we're really wrestling with over a period of time, far more internal than external. So really in this section, he is describing the nature of temptation. And one of the things he does, it's almost structured as if he's saying, let me make something very, very clear to you as a beginning point. God is not the instigator of evil. It's like I'm going to be blunt and direct with you. Let me make this very clear. God is not the instigator of evil. God in no circumstances whispers evil thoughts in our mind, nor does he create alluring images in our hearts. That is not God's nature. I think of the biblical concept of be holy as he is holy. God is completely pure. God is completely set apart from human temptation. Thus, we're called to be holy as he is holy. One writer says this in regards to God's holiness. He says, holiness actually has two aspects: the inability to be affected by evil and the inability to cause evil. In both cases, that is the nature of God's very character. God is never the author of temptation. And then the second point that he really brings out, and he drives home so clearly, is that temptation tends to follow a very clear and perhaps even predictable process. And it all begins with evil desire. Interesting that the word that James employs here, it's a word that describes a really strong desire or even a craving. And the word doesn't necessarily have negative connotations. It's just simply talking about a strong desire, something that you are feeling in an overwhelming way. So it can be positive or it can be negative. And in the scripture, it's used in both ways. And I'll use an example in Philippians chapter 1, verse 23. The Apostle Paul, he's speaking very personally, speaking personally to people whom he was very well acquainted with. And in verse 23, he says, "For me to live is Christ, to die is gain. If I'm to go on living in the body, that will mean fruitful labor for me. What shall I choose? I do not know." And then in verse 23, he says, "I am torn between the two. I desire to depart and be with Christ, which is better by far." Same word that's translated evil desires in James chapter 1. But he's describing this very spiritual experience. I desire this strong craving. I desire to depart and be with Christ, which is better by far. Same word, interestingly enough, is used in Matthew chapter 5, verse 28, where Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, "For I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart." Same language, same term that's translated desire, same language is used in that passage in the most negative way possible. So here's what I'd like to do this morning as we consider this passage, consider its message, and consider the significance of some of the language. I want to just slam on the brakes. I'm going to throw it into reverse going 75 miles an hour down the highway. Let's just slam on the brakes. And I really want to pose an important question to every single one of us in this room. What are you desiring right now? At this moment, or maybe this stage in your life, what do you desire more than anything else? Perhaps you could even characterize it as a craving. What are you craving or longing for at this moment? Can you name your strongest desires? Then a little follow-up question. I think it's an appropriate follow-up question. Once you can name, identify those desires, do those desires honor God? And could you conclude honestly that your strongest desires really are pleasing to Him, pleasing to God? They would please Him, and they would be characterized as being the desire to fulfill His divine will in your life. Might be entirely accurate. It might be, you know, my strongest desires, I don't really struggle, if I'm going to be totally honest with myself, I'm having a hard time reconciling my strongest desires with things and issues that totally honor God. Let's go back down the highway. I just slammed it into reverse for a moment. Let's go back down the highway. As the process continues, we're taken in by not godly desires, but instead we are captured by evil desires. So James says, as this predictable process continues, a person is dragged away. I don't know, I'm a visual learner, so this is the image that comes to my mind, and I think, if you were at a store in a large metropolitan area, you're in the parking lot after you exit the store, and a stranger comes up from behind you and grabs you and tries to drag you away, are you going to go willingly? I can tell you, I'm not going willingly. They may drag me away, but I'm not going without a fight. And I suspect you are not going to either, whether you are 5'1 and 95 pounds or whether you're 6'7 and 200 pounds. I suspect none of you are going willingly, because the very idea of someone dragging you away, you can't fathom that in your mind, nor are you going to tolerate it. So this process that James describes, what he's saying is, We allow evil desires to grab us. Not in a parking lot at a store, but they're grabbing, these evil desires are grabbing our minds and dragging us into a dark alley of sin. And the consequences are predictable, but never positive. That's the phrase, dragged away. Think about someone dragging you away with the specific intent of harming you. Then he uses the word enticed. Interesting word, enticed. It describes the concept of being lured or hooked. And in the original language, it was a fishing term. Like a fish being hooked, like using a lure as a source of bait for a fish. So what he's really saying is, oh yes, by the way, you've been baited. In the process of being dragged away, you have been baited. You bit the bait at this point, and you are hooked. So now that we've just spent just a few moments with the terms in this passage, let's think about the overall scope. Let's think about the bigger picture. And I do believe that some perspective on this section in James is in order. And one just point of perspective that I would note is, if you coddle evil desire, and I think, does that communicate well, coddle it? I'm going to coddle it. I'm going to hold on to it. I'm going to coddle evil desire. If you coddle evil desire, then you end up embracing being enticed. Coddling evil desire is equivalent to being enticed. And when you allow temptation to linger, you're eventually going to do something foolish. And I would add, and I know this is so fundamental, I almost started to leave it out. Temptations are tailored to the individual. In terms of spiritual warfare, those temptations, they're tailored unique to you, unique to the situation you face in life, unique to every component of your life. So I could just stop here and simply say, don't let temptation get the best of you. Don't let your evil desires carry you down to a dark alley. We could stop there, but I believe that may be a little too simplistic. I do believe that there is a fitting and very appropriate follow-up to these thoughts. So what James is describing, again, is not necessarily an external event, but an internal process that's going on perhaps even continually in our minds. And James, in an indirect way, is encouraging us to take a hard look at the desires and thoughts that we choose to foster. So I asked a moment ago, what are your strongest desires? Maybe an appropriate follow-up would be, what sort of desires are you allowing to be fostered in your mind? What are your strongest desires? Can you name them? And what do you long for? An author by the name of David Benner, he actually wrote a book entitled Desiring God's Will. It's an excellent little piece of work. And here's a quote from Benner's work. Here's what he says. The human journey, particularly our spiritual journey, is shaped by our deepest desires. More than we expect, we get what we most desire. That is why it is crucial that our basic heart direction be solidly grounded in God, and that we allow God to purify our desires. And I think my follow-up, my reaction to Benner's quote here is, only God can purify our desires. When we choose to align our very hearts with the divine will of God, God purifies our desires. I think of Psalm 139, verses 23 and 24. The psalmist says, "Search me, God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts." And then in verse 24, he says, "See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." That's a good heartfelt desire, just to come honestly to God and say in a prayer, "See if there is any offensive way in me." And furthermore, I think of the first couple of verses of Psalm 42. "As the deer pants for streams of water, so my soul pants for you, my God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God." So when I think about all of us who are present this morning, I think back to those two little boys, the fourth grader and the second grader, on first day of school. The older boy, he was up early and dressed early. And the second grader, well, it was a little different story. He was getting dressed when it was time to leave, declaring his dislike for school and refusing to take pictures. I just love that kid. I have to say, I just love that kid. But I think about us, and I think about my own experience in second grade. When I finally did show up that day, I had one of the best teachers I have ever had, period, and I'm including all of my college work and everything. Hands down, I had one of the best teachers ever in the second grade. She instilled confidence. She was fun. She was tough as nails. But what a wonderful experience in the second grade. So this morning, if you had a scowl or if you had a smile, I hope when you come and you're a part of being together, that you're transformed, much like I was transformed in the second grade. So a fitting invitation for this morning is this. How are you being seduced by sin? That's an appropriate word. That's a good synonym for the language we've looked at this morning. How are you being seduced by sin? You're willing to be honest. And the second piece, second invitation, which I think may serve as good homework for the week, can you name your desires in the very presence of God? Let's stand and sing an invitation song this morning.